Welcome to the China in the World podcast, a series of discussions examining China's foreign policy and shifting engagement with the world. Brought to you by the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing and hosted by Paul Manning.
Welcome back to the Carnegie Tsinghua Center's China in the World podcast. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Bloomberg reporter Peter Martin to the show to discuss his new book, China's Civilian Army, The Making of Wolf Warrior Diplomacy. And given Peter's outstanding journalist credentials and his time in Beijing and the China watcher that he is, I'd also like to ask him some other issues related to developments in China and Chinese foreign policy in U.S.-China. But before I delve into the interview, I want to first introduce Peter's background. Peter has worked as a reporter at Bloomberg for 5 years now, first as a China government reporter based in Beijing. That's where Peter and I had the chance to get to know each other, spend some time together on the Beijing streets. And now Peter's in Washington, D.C., where he's a defense policy and intelligence reporter. Previously worked for APCO Worldwide. He's got a master's at the London School of Economics and a master's at Peking University in International Relations, originally doing his bachelor's at the University of Oxford. His first book, China's Civilian Army, was published this summer via Oxford University Press. To anyone who hasn't picked up a copy, I would highly recommend you do so. Peter, it's great to have you join us today on the China in the World podcast, and I'm looking forward to our discussion.
Thanks so much, Paul. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before I delve into your book, I just want to start out by sort of getting your take on a number of recent developments. You have worked as a journalist in Beijing. And so, you know, let me just start first, if I could, by asking you your perspectives on the media environment and how we're seeing that today. I saw last week some reports that several foreign journalists that were trying to cover the recent flooding in Zhengzhou had faced intimidation, you know, from locals on the streets. That's not necessarily new, of course. I mean, we don't have journalists in China anymore from the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post. Visa issues for journalists and harassment and intimidation have been perennial problems. What was your experience when you were based in Beijing? And how do you assess the current environment for foreign journalists in particular? How much has the situation worsened in your view? And what do the trend lines look like as we consider the changing political environment under the current leadership and a likely unprecedented third term for President Xi next year at the 20th Party Congress?
It's a really important question. And if you look at reports from the Foreign Correspondents Club in Beijing in recent years, you'll see that they report a deteriorating situation in terms of conditions for foreign correspondent, which I guess really tracks a much broader clampdown on expression, on any form of criticism or dissent against Xi Jinping's government. In terms of my personal experience, what I would say is that in general terms, unless there's some unusual thing going on, the Chinese government tends to feel like it has Beijing pretty locked down. They kind of know what's going on the streets. There's a little bit less of that kind of on the street harassment. But yeah, when you move out into the provinces, it's really rolling the dice. You know, sometimes it's a very smooth experience. You're not bothered at all. At other times, even when you're reporting on the most innocuous of stories, you can feel a very, very heavy presence. And, you know, the more sensitive the story, the more likely that response is to be pretty full on. As you know, when it comes to issues of whether the Chinese government can look after its own citizens and ensure their safety, that yeah, starts to become a question of Communist Party ruling legitimacy. And I think, you know, with the floods in Zhengzhou, the party state kind of felt the eyes of the world on them. And there was a strong incentive there just to shut down any negative reporting. You know, from the perspective of local officials, even if that stuff plays badly internationally and harms China's image, it's easier just to rid yourself of the problem.
Yeah. And when you say when you go to the local areas, you know, you get more pressure, more intimidation. And, you know, I remember traveling as part of the U.S. embassy as a military attaché, and this would happen sometimes to us. And, you know, we were told, well, we're just looking out for your safety and your well-being, which is not something I necessarily bought. But what do you make of it at the local level? Are they worried about getting into trouble at the national level? Why is it so much different once you get outside of the capital?
I think on, you know, on some level, they're just much, much less experienced dealing with foreign journalists. And I also think that the incentive structures change a little bit. You know, in the capital, officials are slightly more likely to take a broad view of China's interests and to recognize that, you know, the way that foreign media report what's going on in China really matters to them. On the local level, they don't really have that perspective of China's image in mind. It's much more like you've crossed over into their patch and you're now a problem for them, and you'll be a problem for them every second until you leave. So that, you know, the incentives are just to, you know, and oftentimes it's confined to the city, right? So like they'll kind of like chase you out of the city, and once you're gone, it stops.
Because it's not there, you know, anymore.
Exactly. And, exactly.
Yeah, there's no upside. They see no upside in you being there. Yeah. And when I said they as an attaché, they said it was they were protecting our well-being. It was when they were following us around in cars and we could see them. It was more for our well-being. Well, let's talk about your book, China's Civilian Army, which I found extremely interesting and engaging. You cover quite a bit in the book, you know, very comprehensive overview of the history of China's foreign ministry, going back, frankly, to the rise of the Communist Party during the Republican era. I liked how you referenced memoirs and personal records of government officials. I think it gave it more of a human face to Chinese history, so to speak. You also covered the ebbs and flows of Chinese diplomacy between eras of more assertive, like the wolf warrior sort of behavior we have today, and the more restrained and sort of charm offensive styles of diplomacy. And, you know, I think some may find it surprising that you argue in the book that wolf warrior diplomacy, as it's come to be known, is not really anything new. It'd be great if you could just start out by talking about your book, why you decided to write the book, why this topic, what key themes and arguments were you hoping to convey, and then say a little bit about why you think wolf warrior diplomacy, what it is, and why it isn't really anything new.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you mentioned in the intro, I'd previously lived in Beijing on and off from 2008 onwards as a student, and then later as a consultant for APCO. And I returned as a journalist for Bloomberg in early 2017. And, you know, it was just this extraordinary moment for China, because on the one hand, Xi Jinping was rolling out the Belt and Road Initiative. He was militarizing islands in the South China Sea, and China was taking such huge strides in terms of its hard power, in terms of its ability to offer others economic inducements, and also to coerce where necessary. And at the same time, the Trump administration was picking fights with US allies, criticizing international organizations. And so there was this kind of leadership vacuum that seemed to be just there for the taking for China. And yet somehow the Chinese system seemed incapable of stepping into that vacuum. And, yeah. And so I started to think about, you know, well, why is that? Why is this system so capable of excelling on these hard power metrics and just really, really struggles with the ability to persuade? And, you know, obviously, you know, one of the requirements for being a kind of political journalist in Beijing is that you go to foreign ministry briefings, and you'd see these highly articulate, smart spokespeople get up on stage and talk in a very stilted and controlled way. And I would talk to foreign diplomats in the city, and they would have the same experience. You know, people who had studied at Georgetown, spoke multiple foreign languages, but when they got into a meeting, suddenly, you know, changed style and became very unpersuasive. And I just thought, you know, this is kind of a human microcosm of like China's broader struggle to communicate, and kind of got into the topic through that.
Fascinating. And so give us a sense, how do you define wolf warrior diplomacy, and why in your view is this nothing really new from the research that you did for your book?
Yeah, so I guess, you know, wolf warrior diplomacy actually is a term that foreign media started using after I had begun researching the book. And
maybe a nice title for your book.
It gave me a nice title, and I think it also probably helped sales. So, you know, I'm very grateful for that. Yeah. But
Right.
And, you know, so there was this 2017 blockbuster movie called Wolf Warrior 2, which was about a Chinese hero posted to the continent of Africa, kind of battling American bad guys and saving the day. And it that movie captured something about that moment in that year where China had this huge opportunity and suddenly had the capability to be much, much more assertive on the world stage. And, you know, Chinese diplomats at around that time also began acting in quite a different way, much more strident, much more nationalistic, far more aggressive in terms of tactics that they were using and the way that they were willing to present a picture of the leadership role that China should take. And so this term, which I think was first used by the BBC's Chinese language service, but I'd be interested to see if people can find earlier usages, but started to be used, you know, wolf warrior diplomats to describe this new style. And what I found as I was kind of sifting through these memoirs that I used for research and doing interviews with former US and other foreign diplomats about China is that, you know, these wolf warrior tactics are kind of, they're a sharp contrast to the low-key diplomacy of the 90s and most of the 2000s. But they've popped up multiple times throughout the history of the People's Republic. You know, in the early 1950s, when China's communist leaders felt very insecure about the place of their regime in the world, they worried that it would be undermined by the capitalist US or a rival government on Taiwan. They showed up and gave an incredibly prickly display at the United Nations in New York in 1950 and, acted in ways that kind of make today's wolf warriors look like wimps. And then again in the 60s, really dramatically, the tactics escalated so far that Chinese diplomats were seen wielding axes on the streets of London, shouting at foreign counterparts, handing out copies of Chairman Mao's Little Red Book. And I started to see, there's an incentive structure behind this, which means that this behavior pops up periodically.
Fascinating. Well, let's talk about the incentive structure. In your book, you make an argument which has gained traction, I would say, in the wake of the U.S.-China meetings in Anchorage and in Tianjin last week with Deputy Secretary Wendy Sherman and Vice Foreign Minister Xia Feng, that the true audience for Chinese diplomats is often right back home in China. Even though they're diplomats carrying out China's foreign policy, the audience is back home. And with the rise of nationalism and patriotism in China, the public often seems to be as tough an audience for Chinese diplomats as Chinese Communist Party superiors are. So can you help our listeners understand better how this works? Is this wolf warrior diplomacy more of a top-down dynamic where they're trying to please leaders within the Communist Party, or is it more a bottom-up phenomenon? In other words, are diplomats incentivized, as you said, the incentive structures more to please their higher-ups in the foreign ministry or in the party or the public audience in China? And then how do they reconcile delivering these messages for domestic audiences with the messages that one would think they'd want to deliver in a diplomatic sense, you know, to the United States or other international audiences?
Yeah, I mean, in much more sort of firsthand sense than me, that it's always a mixture of these things, right? So Chinese diplomats have got to hold these multiple audiences in their head at the same time, just like diplomats anywhere else. But yeah. I would say that the nature of the Chinese political system predisposes them to think more about domestic politics, perhaps, than almost any other cadre of diplomats in the world. And in the book, I argue that that's rooted in both fear and ambition. So, on the ambition side of things, Xi Jinping has laid out this bold vision for, you know, he's said multiple times, China is moving closer and closer to the center of the world stage, mm-hmm. that China won't be intimidated or bullied by foreign powers, right. that it's going to be one of the leading powers in the world by 2050. And so, you know, anyone who wants to get ahead is going to take that tone, match it. And if they're particularly ambitious, maybe they'll even go a little bit further to see where they can get.
And of course, he talks about taking a fighting spirit in doing all of that, right?
Exactly. And so they've got kind of, they need to figure out what those very high level instructions mean in practice. And in some cases, you know, I think of Zhao Lijian is a great example of this.
Right.
Individual diplomats have moved even faster than the foreign policy bureaucracy itself to work towards those ends. But you know, it's not just ambition that's driving this. I think it's really important to remember that lots of, you know, the history of political turmoil and political purges runs very deep throughout the Chinese bureaucracy. And when Chinese officials see that Xi Jinping has instituted a anti-corruption campaign, which has punished 1.5 million officials. He has abolished term limits. He's stressing, you know, Marxist ideological orthodoxy, and he is experimenting with re-education camps. You know, employing tools seen in much earlier periods of Communist Party history as you know, as means of social and political control. They understand what those signals mean, and they understand that, you know, diplomats are often, because of their dealings with foreigners, they're often first on the list when it comes to being accused of disloyalty or, you know, excessive sympathy toward foreigners. And so I think that there's also kind of a fear factor there, which makes them want to act in this very assertive way. And it's a mixture of top down and bottom up for those reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they want to play certainly by the rules for both those reasons. You mentioned Zhao Lijian, the current spokesman at the foreign ministry. Of course, within the last week or two, a former Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Qin Gang has arrived in Washington, D.C. as the next Chinese ambassador. What do you know about Qin Gang, and what do you expect from him in this context? Is this, they say he's got a line to Xi Jinping. Do you expect him to be, you know, one of the leading wolf warrior diplomats? What do you expect?
Well, I guess, you know, Qin has kind of an unusual resume when it comes to being an ambassador in Washington for the PRC. Like Cui Tiankai before him, he is not an America's expert. You know, the foreign ministry does have this tradition of training up US experts from the very early days of their career and then keeping them in those positions for many, many decades. And, you know, Yang Jiechi is probably the most prominent example of that kind of official. Qin is not like that. He spent most of his career dealing with the UK and with Western Europe. He speaks great English, you know, lived in Britain for a long, long time, was promoted to become spokesman in the foreign ministry, and was really very prominent in that role, and, you know, kind of mastered the art of the quick slapdown of Western journalists, which plays very well at home, as you know. Right. But really, you can see his career take off when he gets this job as head of protocol in the ministry. And and so much of what the government and particularly the foreign affairs apparatus has been set up to do under Xi is to present this image of China in the world, which is commensurate with his vision, and also to present this image of Xi in the world as a great leader of China, an international statesman, you know, someone of great renown who has shown deference throughout the world. And really, it was when Qin took that protocol job, it became his mission to put that vision into practice. And that gave him a great deal of FaceTime with Xi, and also a, you know, a huge amount of responsibility in terms of projecting his image. So there's definitely that close personal tie there. And in terms of where he falls on the charm offensive versus wolf warrior spectrum. I think he's someone who it's fair to say is equally comfortable in both roles. You know, he can be funny. He can be very, very engaging. As I say, his language skills are great. And is capable of playing that charm role. But if you talk to European diplomats who dealt with him while he was vice minister charged with European affairs, he was tough. You know, like he wasn't particularly engaging in like public displays of wolf warrior tactics, but behind the scenes, he delivered really harsh messages. And you know, European diplomats who I've spoken to often felt like, you know, they weren't really the audience here. He was trying to show the higher ups that he was loyal to Xi's agenda, as you might expect. I guess just one final thing, which I think is often lost in Washington, because the focus is so much on, well, what are they saying to us? But you know, wolf warrior tactics are never as extreme against the US as they're going to be with, you know, countries like Canada, the United Kingdom, France, because China, as you know, responds to national strength and power, and they know that the US relationship is too important to just let rogue diplomats kind of undermine it all over the place. And so I think that, you know, it's quite possible that we'll see some wolf warrior tactics, but he's going to be a measured operator who follows instructions from Beijing. He's not going to be some kind of loose cannon.
Fascinating. Well, you know, you mentioned wolf warrior in the context of other Western democracies like Canada or the UK, Australia, you know, and there has been a general decline in China's relations with a number of Western democratic countries. We've seen that polling, Pew polling in those countries and other Western democracies, you know, has revealed that opinions of China are at an all-time low in many of those countries, particularly, you know, Western democracies, as I said. And, you know, analysts often point to wolf warrior diplomacy as one of the contributing factors. So, you know, how do you see, you know, as you look at the hardening international public opinion toward China, what's the role that wolf warrior diplomacy is playing in that? But then if you expand it out beyond the Western democratic countries, the picture seems a bit different, especially if you look into the developing world and some of the developing countries, whether you're talking about the Middle East, Africa, Latin America, Southeast Asia, other parts of Asia, like South Asia, you know, there you find more favorable opinions of China, countries along the Belt and Road that are receiving Chinese infrastructure support. So, you know, is Chinese diplomacy more effective in the developing countries, in the areas where developing countries are? What role has wolf warrior diplomacy played there? And then, you know, how has the pandemic affected these dynamics? I'd be interested. It's a big question, but be interested in your perspective on all that.
Yeah, and great questions. I mean, I guess I see wolf warrior diplomacy as, you know, it's both a cause and a symptom of China's worsening reputation. But yeah. I'd see it more as a symptom. You know, this backlash that you mentioned is reflected in the Pew polling is something that has been slowly building since 2008-09, as China began to see a different role for itself in the international system, and crucially, its perceptions of the efficacy of the U.S. political system and America's staying power started to shift. And you know, is really quite deep-seated now, and it stems from policies ranging from, you know, China's industrial policies, which upset foreign businesses, to its human rights record in Xinjiang, Tibet, the crackdown in Hong Kong, the militarization of islands in the South China Sea, and the list goes on and on. And I think what wolf warrior diplomacy has done is to kind of crystallize for many people, to kind of put a face on this idea that China is a threat, China's policies are problematic and need to be pushed back on. So it kind of comes as part of a much bigger package. And as you say, like the response to it across the world hasn't been uniform. It's you know, it's gone down very, very badly across Western countries. The picture I think is slightly more mixed elsewhere. One thing that's quite clear is that the language about, you know, struggling against US bullying and hegemony and not taking lectures from the West goes down very well with populists like Viktor Orban in Hungary, Vladimir Putin in Russia, you know, to some extent, in a more mixed way with Duterte in the Philippines as well. Even if those attitudes aren't shared more broadly outside of those ruling elites. And I think there is also, you know, there's something, there's like a kernel of that message which also resonates more broadly in the global South. Although, you know, some of the most striking examples of wolf warrior behavior have taken place in Venezuela, Brazil, Papua New Guinea. Chinese diplomats literally got into a fist fight in Fiji. And I think kind of most damningly when it comes to assessing, you know, the strengths and weaknesses of Chinese foreign policy, it's gone down incredibly badly in India, combined, of course, with China's military actions on its border with India. And, you know, when you're looking at kind of a balance sheet of successes and failures, it's hard to understand why China would want to alienate a billion person economy that shares a border with it and is close with the United States, and to push that country closer to cooperation through mechanisms like the Quad and, you know, joint military exercises and those kind of things. It really does come across as a pretty monumental failure, at least on that point.
Fascinating. And the global pandemic, you know, how has that impacted these dynamics in your mind? Especially we see, you know, China getting out there and trying to do mask diplomacy, you know, devote significant resources to vaccine diplomacy. Obviously, part of what they're trying to do is, you know, make some gains geopolitically. But how does that all factor into what you're seeing?
Yeah, I think that, you know, many people have made this point that when it comes to geopolitics, that the pandemic has kind of acted as an accelerant of existing trends, a little bit like the 2008-09 global financial crisis. And so what I think it did when it comes to Chinese diplomacy was take an existing, you know, predilection toward assertiveness, stridency, some would say rudeness and aggression, and kind of supercharge that. And I think one of the reasons it did that was because, you know, although Chinese officials have been talking on the one hand about their successes at controlling the virus and genuinely feel like they have lessons they can teach the world and feel confident about aspects of their political system compared with the US and Europe, that confidence is paired with this sense that they are under constant criticism and the sense that they're embattled and it's them up against the world. And, you know, you see this, of course, talking to scholars in Beijing frequently, but I think a lot of more casual observers of China don't appreciate that prickliness often comes from a place of kind of jumpy insecurity. It doesn't come necessarily from a place of strength.
Yeah. Peter, you mentioned 2008 as sort of an inflection point. You mentioned the global financial crisis, but of course, it was also the Beijing Olympics. And in your book, you know, you say that Chinese diplomacy has historically manifested in two ways, one through charm and the other through hostility. You use the 2008 Beijing Olympics in your book as the culmination of China's era of charm effect. And I, as you know, I traveled with President Bush as part of his delegation for the 2008 Beijing Olympics and remember well that Chinese charm offensive. But you fast forward to today, when Beijing is about to host the Winter Olympics in February of 2022, just around the corner. Today, Wolf Warrior Diplomacy is leading their diplomatic approach, not this charm offensive. So how do you expect this to play out? What do you expect from Chinese diplomacy in the lead up to and during the Winter Olympics next year? Will we see changes?
I think it's quite hard to see changes taking place in the short term. There are so many potential irritants coming up, especially in the US-China relationship. You know, we have the midterms approaching. We have Xi Jinping is likely to seek a third term as president. It's going to set up all kinds of kind of anti-China antibodies in the US. There's going to be grassroots criticism of China's human rights record as the Olympics approach. And I think that Chinese diplomats will probably feel compelled to respond to those criticisms in very, very strong terms, just like they did actually in you know, when there were demonstrations during the torch relay before the 2008 games. I think the instinct is going to be to be seen to kind of stand up for Chinese interests. And you know, of course, there'll be a great deal of public and online attention inside China, you know, making sure that diplomats are seen to be playing that role. And, you know, Chinese foreign ministry officials check Weibo, they check online forums, and they're acutely aware of these criticisms. And they're also, of course, acutely aware that President Xi Jinping seems to have a pretty nationalist set of preferences when it comes to Chinese foreign policy. So I think even if they wanted to tone things down, it would be pretty tough for them to do so.
Yeah. Well, look, in the remaining few minutes, Peter, I would be remiss if I didn't just ask you some general thoughts about US-China and about sort of Chinese foreign policy, maybe the 100th anniversary. But first on the US-China, you know, you were in Beijing during, you know, a big part of the Trump administration, if not all of it. And now we've got the Biden team. You know, some in China had hoped for a pretty big, you know, shift in China policy from the Biden team. They haven't seen it yet. They see more continuity. And there's a lot of frustration in China. It doesn't seem like China's doing a lot. They want U.S.-China relations to stabilize, but I haven't seen them offering a lot to, you know, to make that happen. In fact, their narrative is, you know, the Trump administration is responsible for the downturn in U.S.-China, and we'll wait for the Biden team to fix things. So how do you, and you know, you've got the meetings in Alaska and Tianjin and, you know, quite a bit of Wolf Warrior diplomacy type rhetoric used. How are you looking at the relationship today, and how worried are you about it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess kind of strained would be the best word to use to sort of sum it up. The Biden administration came in with this vision that they would pursue. They kind of wanted to change the context of the bilateral relationship before they engage too much directly with Beijing. And so that's where this kind of Jake Sullivan language about engaging with China from a position of strength comes from, the focus on domestic rebuilding, you know, on recovery from the virus, and then, you know, crucially engaging with allies, whether that's NATO allies, whether it's joint work with the European Union, the Quad grouping in Asia, or, you know, just this week, engagement with ASEAN leaders in Southeast Asia. And the whole idea is to kind of try to dissuade Beijing of this notion that the US is in terminal decline. So I don't see, as that goes on, very much space for improvement, partly because that's not where the primary focus is, but also because all of those things, the language about strength and the engagement with US allies, really rattle Beijing. It's quite hard to see very much progress there in the short term. And I also think that, you know, to really undo this consensus, which has kind of become the norm in Washington, that you know, the relationship is on a bad track and it's Beijing's fault, there would need to be policy change in Beijing. Xi Jinping has talked about China cultivating a more lovable image and showing more consistency in its messaging, telling China's story better. But, you know, how do you tell the story of the re-education camps in Xinjiang in a way that is persuasive to Nancy Pelosi? I don't think you can. And so for me, it's really that policy piece, which is the biggest stumbling block. And I haven't seen any sign from Xi Jinping that he intends to change course on any of the major policies, you know, whether economic, military, social, that are kind of driving the deterioration.
And, you know, as you look at the most recently, July 1st, big event in China, important event with the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Chinese Communist Party. She, of course, you know, gave an important speech there. But, you know, given the narrative that you hear from China on U.S.-China relations, given what seems to be, you know, no desire to make any moves on the Chinese side or put forward any ideas or, you know, areas where China might have some flexibility, you know, what does all this tell us about how Chinese leadership views China, how it views its place in the world, strengths and weaknesses, how it views the relationship? Does it feel in the context of U.S.-China that momentum is on China's side and therefore it doesn't make a lot of sense for China to step forward and do things more proactively to try to put the relationship on stable footing? What's your sense of all that?
Yeah, I think that you summarized it really well, actually. There does seem to be this attitude in Beijing at the moment that that friendship and constructive relations will have to take place on terms that Beijing sets, or they won't take place, and that Beijing is in a position to kind of enforce that attitude. I think that, as I argue in the book, there have been these incredible periods in PRC history where the country's foreign policy apparatus has got behind, a posture where China goes out and charms the world, right? It happened in the 1950s. It happened to great effect in the aftermath of the Tiananmen massacre in the early 1990s and, you know, through to the Olympic Games. And so I think China watchers have been grappling for a long time now, with the issue of, okay, so when is this pivot coming under Xi? Like, how bad does China's image have to get in the West before Xi Jinping makes that pivot? And it just doesn't seem to have come. And, you know, his I referenced earlier, he made these remarks to a Politburo study session where he said that China needed a more lovable image, but which shows, you know, at least a tacit recognition that there has been blowback, but yes. Again, the focus is on improving the messaging and telling the story better. It's not on addressing the root causes of grievances. And you know, when you look at the long arc of PRC diplomacy, it's clear that at times there are fundamental rethinks happening in Beijing that aren't necessarily evident on the surface. And so, you know, that pivot may still come, but, you know, I'm doing my best to read the tea leaves. I just don't see it yet.
Yeah. I mean, my last question would be about that speech that you're referring to with the 30th party study session in May, where, as you said, they called on, you know, diplomats and officials to present a more lovable image of China. Of course, at the party centenary, you know, there she is wearing his Mao suit, you know, quite proudly. And then, you know, making these statements that have got a lot of coverage in Western press in particular, that those that attempt to bully, oppress, or enslave China will crack their skulls against the Great Wall of Steel and blood will be shed. So clearly he's not taking up his own advice. What do you make then of, you know, this, what he said at the 30th party session in May, you know, for a more lovable image? Why didn't we see it on July 1st? Will we see a softer tone ahead? Look in your crystal ball, Peter, for the final question. And and try to, you know, predict a little bit about how this will play out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Chinese bureaucracy is going to follow the direction that Xi Jinping sets. And so when Xi makes speeches like that, they're going to take up a very clear signal that they need to repeat that tone. And as I said, like, you know, if they're feeling ambitious, maybe they'll push it even a little bit further. And so as long as those kinds of signals continue from the very top, it's really hard for me to imagine how any great rethink can take shape. And, you know, I think of a conversation I had with a Chinese official a couple of years ago now in Beijing, during the height of Trump's trade war. And you know, this official said, no one now who is below minister rank dares to speak up in a meeting with a dovish opinion on US-China relations, because the sense is that that can only do you harm. It can only make you look weak and disloyal. And so there's kind of this ratchet effect, right? Like if she sets the tone for Chinese diplomacy at an 8 or a 9 out of 10 in terms of assertiveness, that's the starting point for a conversation, right? Like you're not going to go in there with a 3 or a 4 and hope that things work out well for you. What has long puzzled me about the wolf warrior phenomenon, especially as it plays out on social media, is the this space for freelancing, which seems to me completely antithetical to the rest of the Xi Jinping project. You know, Xi is all about disciplined bureaucracies that respond to the leadership of the party center, you know, a Leninist vision for governance in China. And that vision really, really doesn't make space for improvisation on the part of individual officials. And so that's what I found so strange about some of the antics on social media. And so when I first saw that speech, I wondered if we might see a move toward greater consistency in the wolf warrior messaging, not necessarily a softening, but at least an effort to kind of rein in some of the more provocative tactics. And then I think it was the week afterwards, a Chinese diplomat posted an image of a middle finger and said, this is the way that China will respond to its critics. And so I guess that even that tactical shift is not in the cards, but, you know, who knows?
Fascinating. China's Civilian Army, The Making of Wolf Warrior Diplomacy. It's a great book. Thank you for discussing it with me today, Peter. It's a fascinating discussion. Your insights and what you've learned in writing the book are incredible. So thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Paul. It was a real pleasure.
Glad that our listeners could join us today for the China in the World podcast. Our podcast is produced by Nathaniel Scher with support from Carnegie Tsinghua Young Ambassador Jake Libby and Kate Gross-Whittaker. Thank you for listening to today's episode. We'll see you next time.